So without further ado, we'll get started, and I'd like to introduce, we all know Nathan Rothman will be introducing our guest speaker today.
Thank you, Margaret, and it's great to see all of you. Happy New Year to those I haven't seen yet. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest today, a dear, dear friend of mine, Sandy Barber. When I first joined the University of California about 5 years ago, I was raring with ideas and budget and finance and, you know, ready to go. And then I looked across the whole portfolio and thought, oh, you know, athletics, that would be really fun, and the police and parking. And, you know, little did I know that those things would consume about 80% of my time. And athletics was, especially when they intersected, like with the tree sitters that Sandy and I had to deal with.
I know
but,
nothing about that.
But athletics, in a lot of ways, is sort of a microcosm of the university. It, you know, it involved high levels of performance on the athletic front. It involved all aspects of admissions and academic performance. You needed to pay attention to and finance and budget. And I couldn't have had a better mentor and leader in doing in working with me than Sandy. Sandy. Came to Cal in 2004. Before that, she was the assistant athletic director at Notre Dame. Prior to that, she was the athletic director at Tulane. And she was a student athlete herself at Wake Forest, playing both field hockey and basketball. Is that right? Yeah, I guess.
My coaches wouldn't say that.
Yeah, exactly. She always throws the flag with my athletic background, so I can do the same for her. But, you know, what I really admire about Sandy is that she runs that athletic department the way it should be run in a NCAA institution. She combines strong athletic performance. Cal has been in the top 10 in the Director's Cup every year since she's been there, including, I think it was number 3 last year or the year before that. Academic performance. If any of you have the chance, the end of the year student-athlete academic luncheon is one of my favorite events of the year. To hear, you know, you have these all-American or world-class Olympic athletes, and the things that they're doing in the classroom and the things they're going on to in graduate school are just incredibly inspiring. Engagement in the community. You know, I have personally spent thousands of dollars on Cal Athletic Camps, so that's just the start of their engagement with the with local schools and various organizations. In fact, I want to encourage all of you, we are all going as the UCOP to the Cal men's game on October 18th against against Oregon State. February 18th. And then the women, we're going to be going against Stanford on March 4th. Stanford's currently number 4 in the country. So.
Go Bears.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So then where's school?
I'm just saying. There's a few other terms. Yeah, right. But I'm not wearing the blue. So.
Everybody's got to have a black mark.
Yeah. Finally, the thing I most want to say about Sandy Barber, she is a wonderful, wonderful person. Our youngest daughter, Anna, will be looking through, you know, the football media guide or something, and she'll see a picture of Sandy, and she was like 3 years old, and she'd go, "My friend Sandy." So she not only runs the department with high levels of achievement and integrity, but she also runs it as a really wonderful state representative of the University of California. So please join me in welcoming Sandy Barber.
Wow, how do I follow that?
Thank you, Nathan. I'm absolutely thrilled to have this opportunity. Hopefully, something I can say today in the next few minutes will resonate with you. You'll find amusing, inspiring, informative. But to have the opportunity to talk about our intercollegiate athletic program, but to talk about the place of women in college athletics, and maybe a little bit about my journey and the place that holds for me, and then the place that women, our female student athletes, are the women in our department, and the opportunities that women have within our industry. you know, that really excites me to have that opportunity. Nathan mentioned a couple of the places that I've been. I will tell you, I have been very thoughtful, very picky, frankly, about not only the places that we have another Deacon here in the crowd, not only the places that I've had an opportunity to go from an educational standpoint for my own education, although all of this, frankly, has been an education, but the places that I've chosen to associate with along my path to bring me here. And it's been Wake Forest, Northwestern, 10 months, I spent 10 months at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, which at the time in 1982, along with Ohio U, probably had the preeminent sport management program in the country, and a lot of others that have come along since. But Wake Forest, UMass, Northwestern, Tulane, Notre Dame, and now Cal. I look at that with great pride. In terms of, and Nathan, I think, hit it on the head. For me, it's been about educational reputation and rigor and opportunity for our student athletes, being a part of getting them that. And it's been about having an opportunity to excel on the athletic front. And for me, athletics is just like anything else on our campus, any other opportunity. I'm a great believer, and I hope that many, if not most, if not all of you in this room are too, but so much of the learning that is about college, that is about education, takes place outside of the classroom. Obviously, there are phenomenal things that take place in the classroom. But to deny that there are those other opportunities, and yes, I am the director of athletics at Cal, but it's not, athletics is not that only opportunity. But to have the opportunity to do that at a place that says, if we're going to do it, let's be really good at it. And what that translates into at Cal is, let's give every one of our 808 student athletes. 808 on any given day, student-athletes, the opportunity to compete for a national championship. I didn't have that, all due respect. I didn't have that at Wake Forest. Okay? That was a long time ago. I graduated in 1981. We were lucky to have uniforms and equipment and a field that had been mowed, you know, in order for us to play on. But I don't regret that one bit. I am absolutely thrilled that today's young women and young men have that opportunity to have to be a Natalie Coughlin, to be an Alex Morgan, who is now pretty much the face of U.S. women's soccer, which is kind of amazing because she's not even starting yet. But anyway, I think that speaks to what Alex is going to do down the road. But there are a couple of things for me that, you know, Nathan kind of got right out in front there. And that is, you know, those quality institutions. I want to be associated with places that want to do it right, that are about education. Education has been a huge part of my story from a family standpoint for a variety of different reasons. But it's that opportunity, also combining with that opportunity to compete at the highest level. Any depiction of my story would be wholly incomplete without talking about my family, and particularly talking about my father. I am who I am today, and my mother fully endorses this story, this version of the story. But I am who I am today because of my father, and because of who he was, and because of the guard he let down, and decided that it was okay to have a daughter who competed in athletics, to have a daughter that he went and fought for at Little League in 1968, maybe. And he did get turned out. I was not allowed to play. That was an interesting experience for me. But I am the third of three daughters to a career naval officer, a Navy pilot. Yeah, close your eyes and visualize that. And not only was I third of three, but there's 14 years difference between my middle sister and I. So it's really funny because as my sisters and I talk about my dad, unfortunately, who passed away about 10 years ago, and talk about him, it may as well have been two different men, two different guys. By the time I came along, he was further along in his career. He was not at sea as much. His infamous temper had calmed down just a little bit. I see some heads nodding. So military family. He grew up a family of cotton farmers in Mississippi. And there are probably a number of things that he did for me to allow me to be standing in front of you today. First and foremost, Sandy, you can be anything you want to be. Now, when he told me that when I was like 8, I was like, cool. Okay, great. A lot of years later, I really appreciate and think about what it took for this man to tell me that, to say that, to feel it, to really believe it. And we can talk about that a little bit later. But a family that completely valued and embraced education. So important. Both my sisters have PhDs. I'm the stupid one in the family. And coming from a situation where, certainly my father went to Mississippi State for a couple of years because he was 16 when he graduated from high school, and his mother wouldn't let him go away. So he went to Mississippi State to a mother that didn't go to college. But that was all part of shaping the story. And because of my father, it was who he was and what he did. He also taught me, not in words, but by action, that not to see black and white, not to see male, female, not to see, and this is his story, not to see officers enlisted. That was really, again, he didn't talk about that to me, he showed me that. And that treat people like family. For him, the Navy was his family. And what that translates to me today is that my institutions are my family. And then obviously, you treat family in certain ways. But 1972, Title IX, I graduated from high school in 77. I graduated from Wake Forest in 1981. As a senior, entering my senior year, All-American field hockey player. My joke with Nathan was I was a pretty good field hockey player. I was not a very good basketball player, but I loved it. So you get two different stories from my hockey coach and my basketball coach. But All-American field hockey player, no scholarship. I went to Wake Forest because I wanted to go to Wake Forest. I went to Wake Forest because my middle sister had married a Deacon golfer. I went to Wake Forest because I fell in love with the campus. I fell in love with the school. Then again, no one was offering me a scholarship. But entering my senior year, the university devoted resources to scholarships in women's sports at Wake Forest. But guess what? They also told the coaches, you have to give them to incoming student athletes. You cannot use those resources to reward your current student athletes. Okay. Fortunately, that made a huge difference for me other than my ego. So those are the kinds of things that we went through. No surprise, given what I've already said, I have chosen sport. I've chosen education because of the competition. I'm drawn to that. I love to win. Probably more importantly, I hate to lose. You've heard me say that before. But, I mean, that's part of it. But it's also about an opportunity to make a difference. I could have out of UMass, I could have gone and done something from the professional ranks standpoint, and still been involved in competition. But this idea of making a difference and providing an educational opportunity for young people over and over and over again, over now 30 years, really has driven me and continues to drive me today. And as I said before, athletics, intercollegiate athletics, and all of those different experiences, good and bad. If you play enough, you're going to get knocked down, you're going to lose, and there is something about that experience that obviously informs the next time. So that's a huge part of it. man's world. I'm not saying the big world is a man's world. It's not, right? there are 122 1A athletic programs, Division 1A, and that A means football, the highest level of football, which is the thing I'm going to talk about in a minute. But so the highest level, Division 1 is the highest level, and then the highest level of the Division 1s is 1A. You've got 1A, 1AA, 1AAA. They changed the names a couple of years ago to Bowl Championship Subdivision Football Championship, so I don't even know what those things are. To me, 1A, 1AA, 1AAA. 1AAA is highest level, but without football. It's basically basketball schools like Georgetown and Gonzaga. So 122 1As. How many women head those departments? How many women are the athletic director? Two?
Four.
Let's start our sights a little bit. It's bad enough, but it's five.
Wow.
It's five. It's five that head combined departments. When I say combined men's and women's, that head the whole department. And then there are another two at Tennessee and Texas that there are women who head a separate women's athletic program. So depending on which of those two numbers you want to use, five or the seven, we're at 6% or 4%. Now, I'm going to tell you something that's really going to bum you out. In 1996, when I became the athletic director at Tulane at the age of 12. Okay, 36. That was young enough, believe me. There were 11 of us. I'm going backwards. Yeah. And there are a lot of reasons that we don't have time to talk about today. But the fact of the matter is we've gone backwards. And that's really disturbing because there are so many more talented women in our space now than there have ever been. And I'm hoping that it's that two steps backwards or one step backwards, two step forwards kind of thing. I believe that it is. Mary Alice Hill in 1983 was the first ever woman to head an entire department at San Diego State. Unfortunately, she less than 2 years later, she was fired. And there's been, there probably have been, depending on how you count, whether you count people like me who've had two opportunities. Thank you, Chancellor Virginia. There have been about 25 opportunities over, these 122 over, now 30 plus years. So the numbers are pretty daunting. There are a lot of issues. Some of them are no different than the ones any of the rest of us in this room face on a daily basis. Football has a lot to do with it. There is no female equivalent for the most part, although there are some exceptions. Women don't play or coach football. As we found out, and there are lots of examples of this, but as we found out in our most recent media rights negotiations with ESPN and Fox, and we can talk all we want about men's basketball and the visibility and how many people come to and women's basketball, some of the things that are happening there, which is absolutely phenomenal. Does my heart good. We can talk all we want about some of these other sports. Ice hockey at some schools, obviously not here on the West Coast, but for the most part. It's football that is driving that train. It is football that's driving the money. There is no other, certainly not college athletics, but I think frankly in higher education, there is nothing else that brings 55,000 to 75,000 people together on a particular Saturday afternoon to any one of our campuses, which makes it magical on one level. It's such a powerful thing for our campuses, and we need to make sure it stays powerful, and I'm about to go off on this huge tangent. It's got to be done right. Nathan said it. There is a greater compliment that I take from folks that, Sandy does it right. Does it within the rules. Does it with student-athletes in mind. That to me is so, so important. So many things that a woman's mindset brings to this. us to be successful, that helped me to be successful. That's not to say that men, some men don't bring some of those same things, and frankly that some women don't have those things. But I think that there are a number of things that I think help set us up for success if we bring the right skill set and the right mindset. And I think the top of that list is humility. This is, again, I'm sure we all have our own stories about what it is we do and some of the challenges and some gross overgeneralizations that we want to apply to our industry or our profession. It's a lot of ego in what I do. There's a lot of chest bumping and chest pounding and I gotta have this and we deserve this and from men and women. And I think to be successful from a leadership standpoint outside of coaching, you have to check that. That absolutely, because you will destroy yourself and you will destroy everything else around you if you try to take that on from an ego standpoint. And I think that that's one of my strengths. I do not care who gets the credit. I just want to win. I just want student-athletes to have a phenomenal experience. That's my win. That's all the credit I need is for a student-athlete 10 years later to pick up the phone and call me or to come back, if I stay long enough, that some place to come back to that place and say, you know what, Sandy? I was really mad at you at the time because, I did something, or I made them, I convinced the coach to discipline them or, do something, or I took some action. And I actually had this happen in Tulane. Come back 10 years later, or 8 years later, whatever it was, and said, I now understand what you were trying to do, and I appreciate it. So that's what drives me. But humility, lack of ego, micromanage. Let me tell you a story. There are a lot of places where being a woman in this business is perceived or is used, and from a language standpoint, as a disadvantage. I hired Tommy Bowden in 1996, at Tulane. We had, 400 consecutive losing seasons in football, slight exaggeration, but we had a lot. And I took over as the permanent, I don't know why we use that term in this business, but as the permanent athletic director, not so permanent. In the fall of 96, we went 2-9. I fired the football coach, who interestingly enough, his name was Buddy Stevens, he was the football coach at Stanford when I came to Cal in 2004. let Buddy go and hire a guy by the name of Tommy Bowden. And it comes out in the press as, he's being feted as the new coach and that, oh, by the way, he went 7-4 and told me about the next 2 years. That's a little bit of my ego coming out there. As he's being feted as the new coach, some media member asked him about working for a woman. And Tommy had a very interesting take. He said, first of all, I like her. I like what she's doing here. I like it. But second of all, she doesn't know anything about football. So she is not going to be all up in my business. I thought that was very interesting. Anyway. And then the final one is about a clear vision. Obviously, leadership is about a vision. But I think that that's something that, again, in the main, women certainly have the skill set and are wired in a way to bring that to organizations. And I think that that is so important I know it's incredibly important to what we're doing in Cal Athletics today, is to have a vision of what we're doing for student athletes, the opportunity we're providing them, our high performance initiative, which I'm not going to get into today, but I would invite you all to explore it. It's something no one in college athletics is doing and can be our difference maker. But that clear vision is so important to translate and to bring to the organization every day to every piece of it. One of the interesting challenges that I have is to not make it about being a woman. Don't worry. It will be, someone else will make that for you. Okay? I promise you. I certainly don't deny it. I honor it, hopefully, in a way that doesn't make it, that doesn't make my leadership, that doesn't make our organizational success about me being a woman. But in the end, as we have success, that will be honored. But I think it's absolutely, in terms of overall success and making your way, is that that's, you don't leave with that. Because, number one, it's obvious. And number two, it's about your skills and abilities and your leadership. And the woman thing, as I like to term it, will happen. It will be appropriately honored as you have success. Certainly for me, probably the thing I struggle with the most is, again, go back to those numbers. But is that as one of few, as one of the 4%, that's more pressure. When I became the athletic director at Tulane in 1996, the thing that was most remarkable about that was, I was one of 11. Actually, I think it was one of 18 through 11 at some point during my three short years there. But it was that it was in the D South. It wasn't that I was a woman. It wasn't just that I was a woman. It's that I was a woman at a football school in the Deep South. And ultimately, that was my downfall. There's no doubt about it. I talked about that football success. And the big questions were, I was the interim because I was there as an associate AD. My boss left to go to Arizona State. And I was the interim for several months, and nobody thought I was getting the permanent job. Again, the permanent job. Nobody thought I was getting the job, except me. And even at that, I didn't know I would. I knew I had a chance. And I remember walking in to a speaking engagement, a luncheon speaking engagement, like their quarterback coach kind of thing, and with one of our alums who was a very good friend. I said, Conrad, anything in particular you need to touch on? What do you... Yeah, Sandy, you need to tell them how you can be the AD without having played football. Yeah, how about that? And I said, okay, Conrad, that's interesting, because the previous guy, who you all love, was a track coach. He's been a track coach. He was like, I never thought of that. My biggest concern, the truth of the matter was I was fired at Tulane after 3 years because we had a new president. When the president came in, I was a little bit of a victim of our own success. We'd gone from 2-9 in football, and that's 400 years of losing, to we hired a guy, my administration hired a guy, that went 7-4, 12-0, and then he left to go to Clemson. He went mostly around a little old Tulane. But it was new president, new day, the guy who's in charge, we're like, okay, now we're here, we can, Sandy's, I don't know that they even acknowledge this in their head, but Sandy's gotten us here, but now we can be really good. So let's go get somebody that's really good. And they had a new audience and new leadership. You know what? I wasn't happy. Obviously, it was it hurt my ego. I didn't know where my career was going at that point in time. But it was the president's prerogative. how it goes in this business. You know, I took my cue from when a head coach leaves, he or she comes in and they hire all their own assistants. That's what it was. And the one thing I did that was one of those instantaneous things that I had to decide at the time, but take the high road, be positive, da 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 da. I mean, it just, and I can tell you 100 stories about that. But again, with only 5 of us in this business as 1A athletic directors, there's a lot riding on our success. But I will tell you, the good news is there are literally hundreds of women that are as talented as the 5 of us, if not more talented. And some of them have made decisions they don't want to be ADs. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. These jobs are hard. They are really, really hard, and they're not for everyone. And you know what? There are days I wish I had not chosen to do this. But in the end, it always wins, and I show up for work the next day. So, you know, it's how you define success, how you define the top. Some of them have defined it as something very different than being an AD or being a commissioner. You know, have they been champions? There is nothing more important than having a champion. And I wish that Nathan was still here, because I have, through the course of time, had mentors that I've had male mentors, I've had female mentors. You know, I was coming up the ranks at a time when, again, there were no role models in terms of ADs. I had a lot of associate ADs and a lot of folks across this country that put their arm around me and said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I cannot thank them enough. But I can't thank guys like Kevin White, who was my AD at Tulane, and the guy that rescued me from the ashes, if you will, hired me another day and said, you will be a BCS AD within 3 years. Okay, it took 4. you know, kind of like my dad, do whatever you want to do. So Kevin, Phyllis Bailey at Ohio State, said Leland and Stanford, interestingly enough. Ted was the associate at Northwestern, who hired me in 1982. And then Nathan here. You know, it's been a roller coaster 8 years, to say the least. And I have turned to Nathan, you know, certainly more times than not. And he has been my personal champion and my professional champion and my sounding board and my, you know, get your you know what out of your you know what. So we all need those. Let me just speak briefly about what we all love to and need to talk about, which is this work-life balance thing. It's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge for all of us. And I'm not just talking about being able to have a family. That's certainly important, and it's certainly something that we've got to protect and honor. But I'm talking even more basic than that, about having a life outside of work and having you know, the ability to disconnect. You know, these little smartphone things that we carry around, best and worst thing that ever happened to us. It's great because we can be anywhere. We can go do our work anywhere. We can go away. We can whatever. But it's horrible because we're never disconnected. This morning as I was getting dressed, there was something on like Today Show about Brazil is starting to provide overtime pay for taking phone calls and emails at home outside of work hours. They call this we're technology slaves. Interesting. Anyway, in athletics, we're not very good about setting boundaries because we have events on Saturdays and Sundays. We have student athletes who do knucklehead things at 2 in the morning. That's usually when those knucklehead things happen. So then that translates to my football coach, you know, calling at 10 o'clock at night or 6:30 on a Saturday morning to tell me that he's lost the football coach to Washington and the whole world is about to explode, which actually it did. I think that's something we got to work on. And frankly, sorry guys, women are going to lead the way in that. And it's things like, I don't have kids, but I have dogs. They're very needy too. But one of my employees came to me and said, you know, Sandy, you're always having these meetings at 8:30. And I drop my kids off at daycare or school or whatever, and I can't, it's really hard for me to get here at 8:30. Now, this is someone who works her tail off, so this is not an issue of, you know, not living now, whatever. And I was like, you know what? Somebody just needed to say that to me. I don't drop the dogs off to daycare. They have a dog door, and they go out, and they do this thing. Well, of course I'm going to adjust. Absolutely. So it's being open to that. It's being open to your people. It's being open to your family about their health, about their rest and recovery. Because frankly, if we think that we drive people for hours, you know, whether it's hours, whether it's, you know, the connectedness with these darn smartphones, or, and that's a good thing for our company, our entity, our department, or whatever, we're kidding ourselves. I learned 10 years ago, I never took vacation. How stupid was I? 10 years ago, I started taking considerable amounts of time, considerable for us, right? All together. Because it gave me an opportunity to really power down, get some rest, read some books, be with my family, drink some wine, do whatever it was. And then when I came back, I was better. I was much better. So those are things we have to bring to the workplace. And we have to set boundaries. It's again, it's not just about kids. It's about us. And it's about us being the best uses we can be in the workplace, with our families, with our colleagues, with our neighbors, in our community, whatever it is. I will leave you with one story that I think says it all, just about some of the interesting and fun and challenging and complex things that have gone on in my 30 years. And I'll bring it back to football. You know, football is that complicating factor in a wonderful, powerful, entertainment way. And this is the story I'm going to tell you is about Tulane, but there was also a similar story that happened here. Since you all know already football coaches, I won't tell that story. So I became the athletic director at Tulane. And our football coach, I have this thing about, I want our student athletes to see me present. You know, at the end of, some of you all have seen it, at the end of basketball games, is when I'm there, I go down to the, you know, last minute of the game, I go down to courtside, and whether we win or lose, frankly, it's more important when we lose, when we win or lose, I'm there to welcome those kids off the court, to welcome, you know, our staff, and, you know, good job, tough one, whatever. I'm not saying anything that's, you know, any big deal. But I do the same in football. And frankly, there's this thing about the locker room in football that's really important. And, you know, sometimes you take donors into the locker room. Sometimes you take other administrators, you take the college president or the college chancellor or the, you know, the whatever. I mean, it's a place to be, right? So I become the AD, and so of course I'm going to be in the locker room post-game, right? Well, I meant to talk to the coach about it. No, it's not that bad. No. So we win the game, and we win my first game. So we win the game. Yeah, we lost the next 9 in a row. But, and, you know, I'm at the edge of the field, and I'm welcoming the kids off. Great job, guys. You know, give the head coach a hug, you know, the whole bit. And then they tuck off, you know, towards the locker room, and I follow them in. And I'm standing there at the door. I didn't go all the way in, like, you know, hugging or anything, but the head coach is, you know, in front of everybody, and he's, great job, guys, and da-da-da, he's looking around, and he sees me. And you, I mean, he's like, ah, 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 ah. And you can tell he's looking around, does everybody have clothes on? And, so anyway, he does this thing, and then he comes right over to me, and he says, oh, I'm so happy you're here, but we gotta figure this out. And I said, yeah, no problem. No problem at all. We can figure it out. Okay? So we're on the plane, and we're headed home, and, he leans, I'm sitting in the row behind him, and he leans over, and he goes, I gotta figure it out. And I thought he was maybe talking about our defense, which had been a little porous that day. And he says, I said, great. What? And he goes, the locker room thing. Okay. What? And he goes, I'll tell the guys to keep their clothes on until after we're done, after you leave. I'm like, that'll work. So these are the things we deal with. Welcome to my world. But, you know, I mean, that's just a fun little story about, you know, what we consider to be insurmountable odds in any given situation. So thank you for your kind invitation. Thank you for listening, and I'm happy to answer questions or tell more stories or whatever I can do.
You haven't talked much about Cal. And there must be a lot of stories there.
I have to tell you, I'm writing a book. I have been encouraged to write a book. I think the title is something about tree sitters. Cal, from what perspective?
Just any of these anecdotes. Like, what was it like coming there for the, you know, from...
Well, first of all, Notre Dame and Berkeley
could
not be more different in just about every way imaginable, other than they both have phenomenal people. Phenomenal people. So, yeah, the road traveled from South Bend, Indiana to Berkeley, California was a wonderful one. I will say this, as you go through my my career, 9 years at Northwestern, 9 years at Tulane, 4 years at Notre Dame, and now 8 years at Cal, that's pretty stable for, not in your head, that's pretty stable for this business. But, you know, it was, you know, Bob Virginio stuck his neck out to hire me, no doubt about it. It was a shock to the system. The longer I'm here, the more of a shock I understand it was. Because I hear more stories, and, you know, I mean, for me, I mean, I knew it was going to be, oh, my God, we hired a woman? Oh. But I'll be honest, the first reactions I got weren't the woman thing. They were the, what does she know about a cow?
Yeah.
She's from Notre Dame. She's an East Coaster.
Right.
She's never lived in California. I think some were comforted by some of my California background, including the fact that I had a sister who lived here for 45 years. She's married to a Cal grad. My grandfather was born in San Francisco. My mom was born in San Diego. You know, so there's some connections there. But I think it was more that than anything else. Then the woman thing came. But we all have opportunities that are put in front of us. And mine was twofold. Mine was, number one, the opportunity to keep Chuck Pepper. He was the hottest thing on 2 feet in college football in 2004. And we kept him. And so even the biggest detractors, because again, it's about football. What does a woman know about football? So even the detractors stepped back and went, oh, okay, he stayed. He likes her. He wants to work for her. She knew what to do to raise the money to be able to keep him. Maybe she's okay. You know, there've been setbacks. The tree sitter deal, you know, got laid at my feet by some. I think that's wholly unfair, but it did. Again, people want to find a scapegoat. The sport cut thing got laid solely at my feet, which it should have been. Okay? And, you know, more recently, this whole issue with our two coaches leaving to go to UW was a huge firestorm for us. And Jeff took some of the blame. I took some of it. You know, I'll defend that position all no one person is bigger than the program, and we are not going to pay a position coach $500,000 just because somebody else decided they thought it was worth that. So that's all I'll say about that. Yeah.
Thank you again, Danny. I had a question. So I read an article this week. It was mostly related to tech, but I think it applies to all women. It was in regards to women not touting their accomplishments, you know? And so I was wondering, one, what you thought of that, and two, how do you balance the need for touting your accomplishments to the humility that you mentioned?
Yeah. Was that one in the New York Times?
I don't remember. I think
there was a great article in Excellent Leadership by a woman CEO who's in tech that if you get a chance to read, go back and look at it. It's awesome. That's a fine line, and it's something I've had to learn because that is not my not my inclination. My suggestion is you find ways to have others do that for you, and do it purposely, and then I think you have the advantage of both of maintaining your humility. Certainly your parents, though. And, but she's right. I mean, that's a really good question. I remember when Tommy went 7-4 that first year, somebody from the conference, maybe the commissioner, was saying, Sandy's so awesome, congratulations, great hire, da-da-da. Of course, I was going, team, and he kind of grabbed me by the collar and said, hey, you're going to get blamed when things go wrong.
Right.
You darn well better take some of the credit when they go right. So it is. It's a balance. But there are ways, and my staff is awesome. My leadership team is phenomenal, and they have my back in that way that, Sandy, we need to promote this. I got a national award a couple of years ago that I wanted to go away. And they were like, particularly Teresa Gould, my chief of staff, was like, we're putting that up on CalGARES.com. We're sending out there. We're doing a video. And I'm like, but they were right. So it's a combination of a lot.
No. How do you get to, you talked about, doing things right. When it comes to academics in an institution like Berkeley, what do you do to ensure that those coaches do? My husband was an ex-Cal football player who then became a dentist. And when he was, needing support for academics, he was asked stuff like, what do you want to do that for? You need to be out here doing this, getting to the 49ers, doing blah, 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 blah. So I just wonder, what is it that you do to ensure that your coaching staff, support the career after Cal football or basketball or whatever?
Let me say that part of our culture of winning, and particularly the rewards that we put on that, the salaries, the financial incentives, the adulation incentives that we put for those that are in leadership positions make it a huge challenge. But it starts with who you hire and that they value that your coach, from coaches to head coaches to assistant coaches to equipment room personnel to associate athletic directors to obviously your academic counselors to you name it. And we employ about 250 full-time. Every one of them has to understand they are an educator first and foremost. Some days we're more successful at it than others. But it has to be your culture. It has to be an everyday thing. And this is what we talk to our coaches about, that, the message every day can't just be, hey, you improved your time at the 40 or, great work today at practice in the blah, blah, blah. But, hey, how was that history exam? Did you go see your tutor? I know you were supposed to meet with a professor on that. Did you do it? Celebrate their B+ on that paper, because that's how the signal gets through that's as important as the 4 sacks they had on Saturday. It's an everyday thing. It's never done. And now I will say this, that at places like, again, my experience is Cal and Northwestern and Notre Dame and Tulane, even at our worst, we are so much better than a lot of other places. So when I really get down about something that hasn't gone right, I think about that.
A quick question about how your mentor style. When you see a woman athlete that might be an AD, how does your team support that? And what kind of mentoring did you get to come into that frame?
Yeah. I think it's one of the things our team does very, very well. Again, I've mentioned Teresa Gold, but particularly Teresa. I would love to have more time to do that. I have to sneak my moments in. I had a particularly good one not too long ago. One of our track kids, who also work study does event management for us, was walking down the hallway, and I was walking down the hall and kind of intersected, and she goes, "Sandy, you got a minute?" And you know what? Unfortunately, I didn't have a minute. I was late for a day, but I was like, "Yeah." Of course I do. And she goes, anyway, bottom line was, I want to be an AD. And can I come by and see you? Can we talk? I would love to. I said to her, we're going to have some unconventional hours here to get this done. But nothing would do my heart better than to help you get there. And it goes back to Phyllis Bailey, icon of the 60s and 70s in intercollegiate athletics, saying to me, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" When I said, "I don't know," she said, "Well, when you figure it out, let me know if I want to help you get there." So that's, it's giving them time and space and touch and helping them to understand the sacrifices and the skills, what it's going to take, and how they need to figure out whether that's really where they want to go. And there is none better at it than Teresa. Anyway,
I'm interested in why you think there's been backward movement in the number of female Division I ADs, because I really didn't realize that the numbers have gone down so significantly, and it's a surprise.
I attribute most of it, not all of it, but I attribute most of it to the fact that the jobs are ridiculously crazy, and most really, really smart women that ultimately can't be the ultimate answer, but I think that's some of it. I encounter so many women who are so talented that applaud me and say, "You go, girl, and this is great," but not me. With a, you know what you put up with? Not happen. So I think we have to change some of that perception. I think we have to change some of that reality for men and women in this business. We're all going to burn out. People are going to be in these jobs for 4 or 5 years and go, I can have much more of a life, make more money, not that it's about money, because if it were, But that's the only thing I can put my finger on. Because the good part, I said it a couple of times, I think that there are so many more talented women who have been drawn to our profession, not to the AD jobs, but to our profession, and have been given an opportunity to have incredible experience. For a long time, women were pigeonholed in what was called, and still is today, the senior women's administrator position. And maybe they got to play with a few sports, and they headed up, or they were involved in academics or compliance. I mean, I came up with one side of business. And that's another, I can talk about it, that's another rarity in terms of me having the opportunity to be where I am. That's no longer true. You have women that are doing, that are, heading fundraising or heading marketing or heading, whatever. If Teresa weren't married to one of our football coaches, she'd be in charge of football. Unfortunately, I can't do that. So those barriers are breaking down. So I really do believe in my heart of hearts it's one step back, two steps forward, but it has been discouraging. And I think part of it is that that a lot more women than men, and again, it's an overgeneralization, but a lot more women than men take a look at it and go, not worth it. Not worth it. And as a part of that, I really admire. But as a part of that, it's like, go for it. Be as crazy as I am. Anyway, last one.
So this is a comment, not a question, but I fought Little League the exact same time you were at the city, county, and the state level here in California. And if I'd known in 1968 and 69 there was another 9 or 10 year old girl doing the same thing, damn, we would have had a good class action. And it was my mom and my dad in the sidelines, but mostly my mother was behind me supporting that, and my three brothers who all played baseball.
Yeah. I mean, what's so interesting about my dad, and, you know where I started this, but is that, he grew up in the deep south. He, you know, if he were alive, he'd be 92 today. And he was a military guy. In 1976, the Naval Academy started accepting women. And we were living in Annapolis at the time. That's where my parents had retired. That's where my family had retired. And my parents, my dad, had classmates who were sending, up to that point, sons to the Naval Academy. And my family always sponsored them. We lived about 4 blocks from the academy. And so in 1976, this first wave of women, classmates, daughters, started to come to the Naval Academy. And my dad was completely against it. One of the few things that I ever thought about. That was cat. But I was like, Dad, we're not sponsoring those women. You know, I don't believe in this. Da, 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 da. Well, as angry as I was with him in that moment, I was very proud of him several years later when the will of my mother came through, and she said, yes, we are sponsoring them, and we did, and they came over to the house, and they drank our beer, and, you know, everything else. And once he put a face on it, and knew how talented and loyal to his family, the United States Navy, he completely changed his mind. And that was a really beautiful time.